discussion of the developments in the government of the church. And we saw yesterday that the system of church government in the first century was the collegiate eldership over the churches. That in Clement's very important letter to Rome on the subject of church leadership, there was no evidence of a monarchical bishop, let alone a pope, in either Rome or Corinth. All you see in Clement's letter is simply one leader in the church in one city giving advice, friendly advice, brotherly advice to another church. No comment. It was not the matter of the Clement was not a pope. He was not giving directions. He had no authority, claimed no authority. He was just simply a brother giving advice. Now, we've seen that the earliest suggestion, in the early second century, A.D. 112, the letter of Ignatius to Smyrna urges a monarchical bishop, and Ignatius, by the way, Ignatius was on his way to Rome to die, to stand trial. He wrote a series of letters, and this is one of them. This is the context of this. But it's very important to note that he is urging an arrangement that does not exist. Secondly, it is in reaction to heresy or threat of heresy. Now see that. And as I said yesterday, there's sort of bad advice, in my opinion. But if sound teaching is not going to prevent the church or save the church from heresy, then a dictator is not going to do it. But anyway, here for the first time you see the division between the bishop and the presbyter. You recall that? You honor the bishop as if he were Jesus Christ, the presbytery as if the apostles under Jesus Christ, and then you reverence the deacons. Whatever that means. Well, I pick up my reading on the bottom of page 26 of this excerpt from the letter of Ignatius to Smyrna. Let no man do aught pertaining to the church apart from the bishop. Let that Eucharist or Lord's Supper be considered valid which is under the bishop or him to whom he commits it. Wheresoever the bishop appears, there let the people be. Even as wheresoever Christ Jesus is, there is the Catholic Church. The question was asked yesterday. Duane, I think you asked this. Why they use the term Catholic Church so early? The answer is that by that they meant, although the word Catholic technically means universal, and this is involved in it, the word Catholic meant Orthodox, true church. And from this time on, during this period, the ancient Catholic Church, they are reacting to heresy. This is a real problem of heresies coming up. We're going to be looking at those at length. But I want you to see that this language, why don't they just say the church? Or just Christian? Well, they use the word Christian. But rather than just say the church, they attach this very often, this prefix or this adjective, the Catholic Church, is an adjective, because they were, in so many of the writings, because the writings are written in an atmosphere of heresy or threatened heresy. So that'd be a good test question. What do they mean by Catholic? Well, they meant the real one, as opposed to heresies. No, they did not. They did not call themselves Catholics. They called themselves Christians. But in writing about the church, they would often say the Catholic Church, because they were writing very often, as Ignatius is, in the context of heresy, as opposed to false churches. And so how can you make sure you have the Catholic Church, or the real church, the universal church, is the universal true church? Well, let a bishop be in charge. That's good. That's his plan for not having heresy. Put one of the elders up, make him a bishop, and then let him say. So if he says it's the right doctrine, it's the right doctrine. If he says that the Lord's Supper is being this the official gathering of the church, the true church, then it is. Honor the bishop. It is not lawful apart from the bishop either to baptize or to hold a love feast. Talk more about that later. But whatsoever he approves, that also is well-pleasing to God, that everything which you do may be secure and valid. See that last phrase? That's what he's concerned about. Now, I want us to see that this plan for church government, the monarchical bishop, did not arise from Scripture. He does not say, this is what the Bible teaches. He says, do this in order that you may be secure and valid. We've got heresies threatening us. This is my plan for protecting the church, the Catholic Church, the true church, from heresy. Yes?
One church. Yes. One bishop over, an archbishop is one church, one bishop over one church, yes.
Is this the idea that eventually led up to the Pope?
Yes, we're going to see that. Now, by the way, as I note here, the church at Rome was the last one to adopt a monarchical bishop. That's interesting. The church at Rome was came behind others in adopting a monarchical bishop, probably because it was stronger and did not need a monarchical bishop to protect them. Don't really know why, but it's interesting. The Roman Catholic Church tries to chase a pope back to the first century. You can't even, not only do you not find a, don't even find a monarchical bishop in the first century. In fact, Rome was one of the last ones, as far as we know. Why this change? Well, these churches, we talk about the church in Rome, the church at Corinth, and so forth, often recognize the authority of a monarchical bishop were often several groups meeting at home. They didn't have church buildings then. It's very difficult to know what they meant by this, but the evidence suggests that, so about the church at Rome, the church met in several places. It's likely that you had a group of elders, collegiate elders, who would function over the church at Rome. When they said the church may have met in several places. If we reproduce that today, which we are not willing to do, I don't think we would do it, but if we reproduce that today, say you would have all the churches in Orlando be considered the church, you'd have a group of elders who would oversee all these congregations instead of a separate group of elders for each congregation. Interesting. But their concept was that this was a congregation, even though they didn't all meet together. Now, later on, they did. We're not really sure about that. We don't know if they met in all different places. We're just guessing about that. But because it may have been because of persecution, they had to meet in small groups. We don't really know. But regardless, the principle is there that whatever they considered the church, a congregation or a fellowship, then he's recommending just have one bishop over it, let him decide. Yes. He's just getting advice. See, he's a powerful leader, and they recognize this, so they arrested him, and he was put to death eventually. He wrote on the subject of martyrdom while he himself was on his way to Rome to be martyred, and he wrote several letters to churches. He's just giving advice. I think wrong advice, but he's just saying this is what you ought to do. He gave his reasons. He wasn't an apostle. Apostles never said this. See. Yes. I think their motives were pure. I think they just chose the wrong way. That never has worked. Theo suggested that James was a monarchical bishop at Jerusalem and used him as a prototype, but he really was not. It seems to have been, as I note here, a rather misguided response to pressure. And I've already talked about this, okay? Come out to see the idea of apostolic succession. Now, this is very, very, very important. The greatest single source of division, as I note here, in the church historically, has been the idea of apostolic succession. Do you realize that the Roman Catholic Church and the Greek Orthodox Church and the Episcopal Church do not recognize any Protestant groups as churches because they do not have the apostolic succession? Now, they don't recognize one another as the true church because they don't have the true succession. The three major episcopal or papal churches. You got that? The Roman Catholic Church of England, that's why, for instance, we're going to see later, I'll see in the next course, in the Church of England, you have the Church of England, but all the, like the Wesleyans, the Methodists, they didn't have churches, they had chapels. Why? Well, from their point of view, to be in other words, the Roman Catholic, the Greek Orthodox, the Eastern Catholic, and the Episcopal or English Catholic, and we'll see how these develop later on, they say to have the church, you've got to have apostles, those in apostolic succession. What they mean by that, those who, and talk about this more, those who are in a direct line of authority. If you don't have apostolic succession, you don't even have a church. Then they disagreed, but then the Roman Catholics would say that the English Orthodox, or the Episcopal, and the Greek Orthodox are not the real church. They're a church, but not the real church, because they don't have the right succession. Now, but they would admit that we're a church at all. But of course, what the Mormons say, you have, in order to have the true church, you have to have apostles. And they've got 12 apostles, therefore they've got the true church. You ever got the follow me? This is roughly the same idea. You've got to have the true apostles to have the true church. Now, Rome says that we are the true church fundamentally because we have the true apostle, that is the Pope. Okay, we'll get to this, okay? You asked some good questions, just asked them too early. Okay? The first suggestion of this concept of apostolic succession is in the letter of Clement of Rome to Corinth, a letter which I've already mentioned. Now, this is another, I have not read from the letter yet, so now I'm going to. Recall from my discussion yesterday, I said that what was happening was that some of those who had been sort of sanctioned by the apostles, leaders in the church, elders, had been sanctioned by the apostles when they were alive, were getting older now, and some newer men were wanting to put them out and replace them. And he's saying you ought not to, and he tells them why. And in this very early letter, this first century letter, we find the first suggestion of succession. The apostles appointed their first fruits, having tested them by the Spirit, that they were inspired, to be bishops and deacons, it's just the two of them, elders and deacons, of those who should believe. Our apostles also knew through our Lord Jesus Christ that there would be strife over the name of the bishop's office. For this reason, since they had perfect foreknowledge, they appointed the aforesaid persons, again, when he said the bishop's office, he means the collegiate eldership. They appointed the aforesaid persons and subsequently gave them permanence, that is, elders for life, because they were appointed, not elected, so that they should fall asleep, so that should they fall asleep or die, you see, other approved men should succeed to their, there's the word, first time it ever appeared, should succeed to their ministry. Men, therefore, who were appointed by the apostles or subsequently by other eminent men with the approval of the whole church. Now, see, did the church pass on them? Did they vote on them? Yes. It was like this. They were nominated by the apostles because they were inspired and voted on by the church. Later on, they were both nominated and voted on by the church when the apostolic age passed. And if they've done that, they've been approved of the church, ministered blamelessly to the flock of Christ in a humble, peaceful, and worthy way, as they've done a good job, and have testimony borne to them by all for long periods, such men we consider are unjustly deposed from their ministry. Now let me summarize this for us here. Some older men were being put out of office, creating strife. He is calling for a succession of the collegiate eldership. He is not calling for a bishop. You got that? Ignatius is the first to do that. What he is saying is that he's calling for a succession of the collegiate eldership who are to be approved by the congregation. All he's saying is that these men, he's not even saying they should perpetuate, they should pass this on. All he's saying is you ought to have a very good reason to put these men out of office since the apostles chose them and they had supernatural knowledge and they've done a good job. So he's saying, I'm just recommending this. Follow me. This is a good friend, not a pope. I'm recommending this. If they were appointed by the apostles, since they had supernatural knowledge, and if they've done a good job, you ought not to depose them. Now, if they haven't, you say, fine. But if they have, ought not to put them out of office. Very simple thing. And by the way, is that a common sense thing? Okay. Now, you find nothing of this is not papal, the Roman Catholic concept of succession, but it uses that word. That's why I say this is the first hint. And Clement suggested that those who were, what he's suggesting is, which is the common sense idea, that those who had been selected, nominated, we would say, by the apostles, had been perhaps trained by the apostles, you could pretty well depend upon these men, especially to protect the church against heresy. They were likely to have the truth, as opposed to heretics. Okay? That kind of common sense approach doesn't guarantee it. He's not offering a guarantee. Now note this, and you must learn this distinction. There was no suggestion at all that those appointed by the apostles had, by virtue of their appointment, the office or authority of the apostles. It doesn't say that. There was no suggestion that they should become apostles. He didn't say to them. Now this is, the Roman Catholic Church traces apostolic succession all the way back here, this kind of thing, and saying you had a monarchy, you know, the Pope.
No, he is not. Notice, he is not. The suggestion is not.
Now listen to me. The suggestion is not that one man be the bishop or apostle over the church. Secondly, there's no suggestion whatever that these men, because they were appointed by the apostles, themselves became apostles, as the Roman Catholic Church claims. You got that? They simply were elders who ought, for the reasons given, because they succeeded from the apostles in the sense that they were appointed by, nominated by the apostles, that they ought not to be put out of office without very good reason. That is the long way, don't you see, from saying that one apostle lays his hands on the, you know, an old apostle lays his hands on a young man, and this young man becomes an apostle. There's no suggestion that they were an apostle. The apostolic authority and power, just that they were should keep their job, their office as elder. Do you see the distinction there? So now, and listen to this wording. It was a call for a succession from the apostles, not a succession of the office of apostle. And that is all the difference in the world, besides not being a call for one man having authority. Okay. The idea, and I typed idea twice there. This is my first publication of this syllabus. You can correct it. The idea of limited succession was not accepted elsewhere for almost 100 years. By the way, you see, this limited succession, which amounted to nothing more than keep these men in the eldership without, unless you have a good reason, because they were appointed by or nominated by the apostles. Not only was this very far removed from the idea of a succession of the office of apostle, this idea was not accepted. His advice was not taken anywhere else for 100 years. This idea, it took a century for it to get hold anywhere else. It's absent from the letter of Ignatius to Smyrna, which we've already read, an excerpt from it. Early literature is elsewhere as sonnets. As far as we know, you got that? The Church of Corinth, if, we don't know if they did, but if the Church of Corinth took this idea, it's a very simple idea, long way from apostolic succession as the Roman Catholic Church means it. As far as we know, the early church didn't even, elsewhere, nobody else thought that was a very good idea. Of course, a lot of churches elsewhere didn't have men who had been nominated by the apostles. The Church at Rome, you see, was under full sway when apparently no apostle had even been there. Even the book of Romans was written. Okay, the next suggestion of apostolic succession, we're going to trace this, comes from Hegesippus, A.D. 178. Now, it's recorded by Eusebius in the 4th century, but it goes back to Hegesippus. Again, he's concerned about heresy, and he argues that truth is more likely to be found, no guarantees again, but truth is more likely to be found in a church founded by an apostle. Now, by the way, with the letter of Hegesippus, you begin to have the evolution, the slow evolution of the idea of Roman supremacy. We're going to see, and I'll just tell you where we're going now, so you'll see it, we'll repeat it, but repetition is the key to learning. You have the idea that any church founded by an apostle is more dependable in terms of truth than a church not founded by an apostle. Well, it's likely, maybe we might argue with that, but anyway, that was the idea, because they were facing terrible problems created by heresy, you see, under pressure of heresy. Keep remembering that. Then, later on, added to this, we're going to see, just looking ahead now, surveying the landscape for you, we're going to see that the idea grew that of all the churches started by apostles, since the church at Rome was started by Peter, who was the chief apostle, then the church at Rome has authority over the other churches. This took several centuries for this to develop, but we see it in its seminal form, incipient form right here. So, hey, you get what he's saying? Under the pressure of heresy, he's saying that any church, not just the Church of Rome now, but any church, by the way, the Church of Rome wasn't even founded by an apostle as far as we know. That's why, see, the Roman Catholic Church, they sort of skip over the first 3 or 4 or 5 centuries. They get their doctrine from authority. The later popes say so. That's why, for instance, this isn't going to cost anything, but I got a scholar who's a, I think loosely attached to the Seventh-day, maybe he is a Seventh-day Adventist. He recently got a doctorate from the Pontifical University in Rome. His name's Bacciocchi, or Bacciocchi is his name. And he showed that
the Sabbath, the Lord's Day, was changed from Saturday to Sunday by the Church at Rome, trying to disassociate itself from the Jews. And it makes quantum leaps in logic. It's allowed, but see, he got his doctorate. His doctorate was accepted with that proposition by liberal Catholic school. It would take a liberal Catholic scholar to accept that argument because there's any evidence for it. But see, the Catholics are anxious for non-Catholics to say yes, the Church at Rome had this kind of authority in the first and second century. They want that idea promoted, and the way they handle their material is a typical liberal method. What they do is they find a gap, and that's where all their evidence is. They find all their evidence in the silence. What they do is they're bound by the evidence. This is how liberal scholarship works. You go along, you're bound by the evidence until you come to a gap. And then, away they go, you see. And they come back to the evidence, and they go along again, you see. So they come to the evidence, they go again, and they come back to the evidence, right? Start it again. And then somehow, so when you're watching the left hand, on the right hand, they slip in words like certainly. Certainly. Somehow between here and here, you get certainly. Well, we don't know, but certainly. It's just, not just in theology. This is liberal. Take my word for it. If you go on, you'll find this. You know, we don't have, like evolutionists do this too. Now, we have no evidence whatever, absolutely. But we know that. You know, I asked my professor once, you know, if there isn't any evidence, how do you know? Well, anyway, this fellow Bacchiocci published this, and boy, the Seventh-day Adventists would be going crazy, and the Armstrongites falling all over themselves, sending out Bacchiocci's work, saying, now we got a top scholars, you know, and I read it and examined it. It's pitiful. And so I wrote back to the guy who sent it to me, some guy in Illinois, Indiana. He sent it to me, and he said, you see, he'd read my book, and he said, you don't know what you're talking about. This is a real scholarship. So I wrote back a letter and told him what kind of scholarship it was. And briefly, why? But then I said to him, of course, no. I said, of course, Roman Catholic. What I said was something like this. Words right. That no Roman Catholic college has the right to give to supervise any doctorate work in any. Are not legitimate historians for the first four centuries, because they rely not on history for their reconstruction of church history, but put upon authority. And you cannot rely upon authority as the basis for historiography. You got to have evidence. It's history. Tell me. They rely upon the authority of later popes for belief in the earlier popes. So it's called arguing in a circle. Therefore, I said I don't know of any legitimate church historian who would take seriously any Catholic historiography for the first four centuries. They don't do too bad after that, but. Because, I mean, if you get a pope in Rome in the first century, you got to get it some other way than history, because we're looking at the evidence, you see. And any church historian, any Roman Catholic church historian who can call himself he can do one of two things. He can either be a historian, or he can try to claim there was a pope in Rome in the first century. But he can't do both, you see, because it simply isn't. And I've given you some of the basic reasons. Well, anyway. So to give you a perspective, it's the kind of thing that goes on. But of course, the Seventh-day Adventists love this, you know, guy. And it's pitiful. His scholarship is pitiful. He does exactly what he does. You know, you got to watch the sleight of hand. On page 3, they don't have any evidence, and in this area by page 5, it's certainly. You got to watch to see that this is where they get you in the gap. And of course, what the liberal methodology is, they quote each other 3 times and become scholarship. He says it and he quotes him and she quotes both of them, and well, 3 of us agree, you know, we're 2 or 3 are gathered together, it's bound to be true. You got to watch these guys. Another thing, if you're ever doing works written by liberals in the field of theology or just scholarship in general, especially if they're Germans, never trust the footnotes. Anyway, I had a professor tell me that one time when I was at the master's level, and I thought he was kidding. But I found out he wasn't kidding. No. Never trust the footnotes by a liberal scholar. You know, if he said, this book says this, look it up. I've found books written in liberal scholarship. I have found liberal, respectable, except liberal works, with footnoting books that don't even exist.
like the Colts, unless side books haven't been written yet. Now they're not. That's not generally so, but it happens often enough. That doesn't follow me. That's not how they most of them work most of the time. But it happens often enough. You can't trust a one of them with fudging throne. Anyway, so certainly, what my point is that any doctorate given by a liberal Catholic university in the field of history, covering the first three centuries, isn't worth the paper it's written on by the very nature of the question. That is by the very nature of the issues. You know, see what I'm saying? Because they just don't. They rely on authority. How do we know that you had a pope back then? Well, the later popes told us. The church said it later on. We know by their authority, not by tongue, not by history. Okay, let's move on. He's what Hegesippus, and I'm going to spend a lot more time on this because than it perhaps deserves as far as space in the syllabus is concerned, because this is so important. He writes this, and the church of the Corinthians continuing the true doctrine until Primus was bishop at Corinth. With them I associated, see by now you have a monarchical bishop. With them I associated on my voyage to Rome, and I abode with the Corinthians many days, during which we were refreshed together with the true doctrine, in the true doctrine. When I came to Rome, I made for myself a succession list as far as Anicetus, whose deacon was Eleutherus. And from Anicetus, Soter received the succession, after whom came Eleutherus, and in every succession, in every city, that which the law and the prophets and the Lord preached is faithfully followed. So he made a succession list. It was not a succession of the office of apostle, but an appointive succession from apostle-appointed elders who are, by virtue of this, more likely to teach the truth. He just took Hegesippus, just took the advice of Ignatius and ran it into the ground. He reasoned this way. Let me put it this way. Clement suggested that we ought to trust men who had been appointed been nominated by the apostles. Okay? Ignatius said we ought to sort of depend upon them more than others and upon one more than many. Hegesippus comes along toward the end of the second century and says, well, if that follows, then if the man who was nominated by an apostle you can count on him to keep you straight doctrinally, then it follows that he would pass this teaching on to others, and therefore, by now you have a monarchical bishop. The monarchical bishop that he would nominate and train, then he would keep that truth, and then he in turn would train and nominate another monarchical bishop, and he would keep that truth. And that's just a good way to make sure you got the true church, the Catholic Church. And so he said, when I went to Rome, I just made a list, finally this succession list, this appointive succession, not of apostles now, see, but of monarchical bishops who were in this line of appointed succession, so that the church at Rome won't have any trouble knowing who to depend upon for doctrinal orthodoxy. See, now the list takes him down to his day, 178. In other words, you get what he's doing? He's saying the question came at Rome, who can we believe? We have different people saying different things doctrinally. So again, they're investing their confidence in men rather than in teaching. And so he simply says, I'm solving a problem for you. When you get to Rome, you don't have to worry about who to believe. All you do is just check on who appointed who. And when you get down to the monarchical bishop who was appointed by the monarchical bishop, who was appointed by the monarchical bishop, who was appointed by the apostle, then, or a bishop, or an elder who was appointed by an apostle, we can be sure that these men would have preserved the truth down through the years. Well, is that true, by the way? Sure isn't. The fact is that somebody is trained, it doesn't mean they're going to stay true. Look at Judas. Trained by Jesus? Was he true? No. And Paul, I always laugh at this idea. Paul would go in and teach, and before he'd get out of town, they'd be messing up what he taught. He wrote to the Galatians, I marvel that you are so soon removed. And in the epistles, wrote to the Corinthians. I mean, they're just all messed up. And he's just been there. The Thessalonians got all messed up, and he'd just been there. So the idea that heresy or doctrinal deviation takes a long time is silly. The idea that you would even have the truth taught in all the churches while the apostles were there is silly.
coming? Yeah, the apostles right on the scene couldn't keep the church straight. All these false teachers coming in. Read the epistles. See? You got all kinds of writing about false doctrine, other apostles, false teachings. Well, the apostles were very much present. So that this is a very bad idea, isn't it? You see, to trust individuals, trust men. Now, but again, it was an appointee succession, and it was not the office of apostle. Now, Irenaeus in the early second century and Tertullian in AD 200, they agreed with this approach to orthodoxy, but again, it was not universally accepted. Not universally accepted. Now, you got that? There were some who were holding this idea. They began to hold it at Rome, but again, it was not even then, it was long centuries before it was accepted everywhere, and someplace it never was. We're going to find some areas up in Europe, up back in the boonies and the fringes of civilization, where they never did accept it. You realize that there are pockets of Catholicism, ancient historic Catholic religion, basically Roman Catholic, but they never have accepted the authority of the Pope. And of course, in the East, they never did. Where was the stronghold of the church? Asia Minor? That's the East. We're going to see later, and this is looking ahead, again, surveying the landscape before we walk through it. But even then, you see, the idea that the early church universally accepted the authority of the church at Rome, that's very silly, because most Christians, just count them, most of the churches were in the East, not the West. The West had a minority of the churches. And the East, nobody ever did accept the authority of the bishop in Rome. We're going to see that later. By the way, you see, the Roman Catholic idea that Peter was the first pope and the church universally recognized the authority of the church at Rome, which he founded, it's got to be one of the most historically absurd ideas you could possibly imagine. I mean, you could come closer to proving that Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs actually lived. And you can come to proving this. Now, that's not quite true, but it's almost true. I mean, it's really stupid. You know, when you get most Christians, they never did accept it. You know, never have. Never will. Well, let's move on now. Let's talk about the dogma. Let's not move on. Let's look back on the bottom of page. And Brad, this raises a question you asked, or answers a question. We've gone far enough now to have this parenthetical summary, which looks backward and forward. You got this? I like it. It helps sometimes, as I say, to look over where we're going before we get there. So this parenthetical summary looks backward and forward. And by the way, it's very convenient to remember. This is the evolution of the monarchical bishop. What we have in the first century? Collegiate eldership over one church. The second century, one bishop over one church. And by the way, that is the form of government accepted by many denominations. For instance, the Baptist Church accepts that today. The pastor, you have one pastor and a board of deacons. By the way, this is a growing movement in our church. Very unfortunate. It is not the first century, not the apostolic pattern. It is absolutely wrong to call the preacher pastor unless he's been elected to the eldership. The word pastor means elder. It is always wrong to call him the pastor unless he's the only elder the church has elected. Following, they elected him alone. He's the only elder. He's the pastor of the church. If that's true, then you have the second century form of church government, not the first century. Because they thought that way. By the way, you see, they were not raised in democracy. They thought in terms of a kingdom and single of a hierarchy, and they were trying under the pressure of heresy again, and this was being recommended to them. So in various places, they accepted this. Yeah. I can remember when I was your age, you never heard a preacher in our brotherhood called pastor. You never heard that. You begin to hear it in the 60s. Now you hear it all the time. You see it even written. It's absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong. Unless, see, he's the pastor of the church. That's very unbiblical. Unless he's the only elder that the church has. Well, he may not be an elder. I never was an elder. I was an evangelist. I was just a preacher. Yes, you have elders who oversaw the church. But they were not necessarily. There were sometimes they did the preaching. Sometimes they did not. Sometimes he gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists. Really, the office of minister, as we know it today, comes closer to being the evangelist than it does any other. Now, some congregations, nothing wrong with this. Some congregations they elect the preacher an elder, and he serves as one of the elders. I have no objection to that. Nothing wrong with that. He's a pastor, but he's not the pastor. The pastor means the monarchical bishop, the overseer of the church. And this is exactly the Swami, the Baptists, for instance, use this, most like most assemblies of God, churches like that, they use this form of church government, which is the second century form of church government, a pastor with deacons under him. Yeah, don't think of a board. Or, now the second century church didn't do it that way. They had this, the pastor, the elders, then the deacons. And I don't know why we're getting into this, calling the preacher the pastor. In other words, if he is the pastor, then we have an unscriptural form of church government. Now, if he's the single elected elder, if he's the single elder of the church, the ruling elder, then we have an unscriptural form of church government. If he's not that, we ought to quit calling him that, because we're using the wrong title. And I suggest that's what we have in most cases. You know, we're calling him the pastor of the church. He isn't the pastor at all, unless. Yes, I think most of the time that's what you're looking at. I never call them that unless they never. You get what I'm saying? It might be a pastor, but if you got a preacher and they're calling him the pastor, you've either got the wrong charm and form of church government, or you're calling it the wrong thing. Usually the latter, it's using the wrong language. Yes, and the same form. Well, no, they're right. That's the only elder they got. Yes, usually. Like in a Baptist church, they say the pastor. That's right. He's the only elder they've got. He's in charge. I mean, he's a monarchical bishop. Board of deacons. You see, that's the monarchical bishop. He's the pastor. He's the elected elder. But that's the second century, late second century form of church government, not the first century. Wasn't that way? And church historians agree. There's no question about it. Yeah, well, technically he's a minister, you know, or all to be ministers. But that's closer. I prefer the minister to the pastor. A minister as a separate office is not scriptural in particular. We're all ministers. I like, if you're going to call him, I like minister, but I like best of all, I like the word evangelist. He's the evangelist. That's if he's not, if he's doing the preaching and he's not elected to the office of elder. I think very often he ought to be an elder. But if he's not, follow me, serve as one of the elders. Let me say this, and I'll just visit with you for a few minutes. You see, there are many ways, and this is what history is for, to learn from, isn't it? There are many ways. There's not this one single way to have a biblical or first century form of church government. For instance, I may recommend some very. I think the way that most of our churches do it is basically sound, basically correct. You know, with a collegiate eldership. Although many churches, they think the elders think they're the boss of the preacher. Well, they are, but I've never seen a church work very well if the elders had that attitude. You're talking about, you know, elders and preacher. Well, okay, but first of all, you're brothers working together. You're on the same side. And where you have elders have a dictatorial attitude, the church will never grow. Because it just isn't really Christian. You want to use Christian as an adjective. Let me suggest a very. I'd like to recommend this, and I recommend it where I preach. I never really pull it off. part of this, this follow me. I think this is a variation of what we're doing that would still be actually. I think closer to what the early church actually did. Number one is that the elders, as far as we can tell, in the early church were full-time servants of the church. They were paid eldership. Read this in 1 Corinthians 9, for instance. Elders worthy of double honor. He's talking about being paid. Look at the context. A paid eldership and having the preacher as one of the elders if he is otherwise qualified. Now, for most of the years that I was in the preaching ministry, I would never accept that, never suggest it, because I was not old enough to be an elder, I didn't feel like. But you see, so you have a teamwork where one of the elders, so the way the early church actually ran was, rather than having the preacher as a hired expert coming in from the outside, what you had was a congregation grew up and they set themselves to the business of teaching. The apostles came in from the outside and taught, and others, but as men prove themselves, these men would be selected to be the leaders of the church, and they would follow me, a collegiate eldership, and many of them at least would be paid so that they could give full time to the work, and they would do different kinds of jobs, one of which was preaching. No. No. There was a separate office. Did you see that? We know that many times the elders were paid. So, frankly, I think it would work better than the way we often do it. You follow me? I think this is an expression of the first century polity. You get what I'm saying? If he's otherwise qualified, has the preacher as one of the elders. Just follow me? He doesn't have any more authority than anybody else. See, in any case, if you have a collegiate eldership, in a properly functioning collegiate eldership, any single, and this is what the early church did it, as I understand it, in a properly functioning collegiate eldership, any single elder is under the authority of the totality of the elders, follow me, of the board of elders, you want to call them that. There's no single elder has authority, and he may have to do something he doesn't want to do if the majority votes for him to do it. See? But any of the elders, that's about the way we work, isn't it? As far as the functioning of the church, any single elder would be subject to the will of the collegiate eldership, the corporate will. And if the preacher were one of them, you see, if he were one of the elders, would he not be subject to the corporate will of the board of elders or the collegiate elders? Yes. And so if he's qualified, let him be an elder, because he often has a lot of good advice to get. The idea that, you know, you can't trust the preacher and, you know, we'll give him a list of things to do, and we'll give him a job description, you better do it. That really is not biblical. I think it's biblical, but it's not wise. In other words, the Bible kind of permits that, but I think the Bible also permits other arrangements which are better. And then, rather than hiring an outside staff, in addition to hiring outside people, say you get one of youth ministry, somebody who, you know, specialized training in youth ministry, as the church continues to grow, to hire men who have already proved themselves, let them quit their jobs and the church support. Many churches, this has been done before. I recommend it where I was, never quite pulled it off. You know, they were so raised in the old ways and other reasons, I never made it. I think if I had stayed another 15 years, I might have made it. For instance, we had men, finally you got a man in the church who's well read in the scriptures. If the evangelist or the preacher's trained him over the years, he found he grew up with the people, know him, they respect him. Why hire somebody from the outside? It takes 4 or 5 years to really get acquainted with the congregation. Let him quit his job, let the church take up his salary, and let him do whatever he'd like, benevolence, whatever he's doing, counseling, you know, evangelism, whatever it is, let him do it full time. The early church did this, paid elders. And follow me? I'm not saying the way we normally do it is on Scripture. I'm simply saying the Scriptures permit, the apostolic precedent permits a little more variety than we really get practiced as a brotherhood. Now, churches have done this, by the way. I know of several instances where they have, follow me, rather than increase their staff by hiring somebody from the outside. Or an alternative, a version of this is that, and some churches have done this, you get a man who's really proved himself over a number of years, the church says, look, you quit your job, and we're going to send you to Bible college. You go there, and you spend your 4 years, whatever, and we'll support you and your family, and you come back here, and you just be a full-time teacher. You can do training. What a man. Think about a man. You get two men. A man who's really good at it. Well, think about this. Follow me? A man who grew up in the church, knows the people, and he's trained this way. Follow me? Sent away. And he's really good at evangelism. So you get a man. He doesn't have to prepare sermons. He doesn't do counseling. He doesn't care about the church paper. He doesn't answer the phone. All he does, he gets up in the morning and he goes out and knocks on doors. He evangelizes full time. Follow me? He's an elder. And that's his job. And lo and behold, you got another man who's not as good at that, but he's a profound teacher. And what does he do? His job, nothing. His full time job, go in the homes, train the new Christians. Right on their own kitchen table. And train them. I mean train them, 3 or 4 years each. One session a week, 9 months a year. And you start, well, I'll tell you, that's how the early church came closer to that kind of program than what we normally do. Sure could. Oh, yeah, well, if you had 30 of your people tithing in any given church, it would work.
If you had a third of your people tithing in any local congregation, you could afford it. You have money left over. That makes sense to you? Well, one of the things I want to do is maybe plant some ideas in your mind. Now, I push for this kind of thing. Now, I think that would work, don't you? And some churches have done this kind of thing. And this is, as I understand, you get what I'm saying? As I understand the early Christian documents and the New Testament, again, this is an inference, it's a deduction. I think they did this. And the Bible college, you see, would have, its function would be not taken away, but enhanced, see, where you can send these men and let them be trained and come in and if you get a man who's good at preaching, you ought to do that. My idea of a perfectly functioning church would have individually trained, equally trained men, all of them elders. Follow me? One of them, and the one who does the pulpit preaching would do nothing else. Boy, when he got up there twice on Sunday, he's been working always, a master pulpiteer. Think what sermons you get. Follow me? Meaty, profound sermons, instead of this light stuff we get, you know, a guy. He said he's done 60,000 other things all week, and what can he put together?